Was your father a genius or a madman to make this movie?
Well, in hindsight, it is a madman. I got 56 stitches in the head, and it took six guys 25 minutes to get the lion off of me. You know, we probably should have figured out then that maybe this is going to be a problem.
Now the clouds have all rolled on, and the storm has come and gone. And while the road was long, the spirit helped us through. Here we are in Eden.
This is a madhouse.
No, it is. It's just like life. You get the funny with the tragic.
Here we are in Eden. Though we hope to stay, almost look away.
See the shadow of the eagle in the sunrise. Hear the music of the children in the moonrise. Feel the power of the lion when he roars like thunder.
Roar.
But you could get killed.
The cat's got a little excited, that's all.
Oh. Why did you bring us here? We're just gonna die.
Roar.
And do you know what your friends are probably doing to our family right now? They are eating.
Shut up.
Roar.
Oh, whose land is this? This is my land.
Okay, are we rolling? Good. Forgotten Horrors Podcast, take one. Do the appropriate music. No. I said the appropriate music. That's more like it. This is Mike Price welcoming you to the Forgotten Horrors Podcast, a blatant exploitation of our new series of Forgotten Horrors movie books. It is my pleasure now to introduce John Woolley, without whom none of this would be possible. And now, the acclaimed author of Soul Soup for the Chickens and others too humorous to mention, John Woolley.
And I'm proud to be here with the voice and the presence of my good friend Michael H. Price, whose latest work is Deep in the Horrors of Texas, which I highly recommend. We're going to be talking about that a little later on. Michael, how are you?
Raring to go, and glad to be here.
Good. Well, we want to thank everybody for listening as well. And tonight, or today, or whenever you happen to be listening to this, we're talking about a film that was really snake bit for many, many years. Maybe snake is not the right animal, but it was certainly bit. And we're talking about Roar, which has been described as the most expensive home movie ever made. And Roar was made, of course, by Noel Marshall, directed it, wrote it, starred in it. He was married to Tippi Hedren at the time. His stepdaughter, Melanie Griffith, is in it. His two sons are in it. And about a million lions, tigers, a couple of elephants, panthers. I don't know what all, tigers even. They brought some tigers from Asia over there.
From the Asian continent.
And I guess I'd like to ask you, Michael, just essentially, people haven't seen it. It's essentially a Disney movie just gone very south.
It's very inspired picture, and Tippi Hedren has always spoken fondly of it, despite the agonies.
Yes, and the real agonies that had to do with big cat bites, so many people in the film, or who were crew members in the film, who were cast members in the film, were hurt in some way or another by these lions, largely, but other animals as well that are featured in the picture. And, you know, it made me think a couple of things. There's not much of a plot. Noel Marshall plays a guy who is doing research on big cats and lives in his house with all these big cats. He's estranged from his family, and his family comes over to visit him in Africa. When they visit him, he's actually gone, so they have all these these adventures where you don't know whether to laugh or cry, especially when you know that some people were hurt, not not horribly, but they were hurt.
And these weren't stunt lions.
They were not stunt lions. They were real lions. Then Noel's character comes back, and then some people try and shoot the lions, and they do, and then the lions get their revenge, the end. I think that's pretty much the plot. So tell me your impressions of Roar. I know.
Drawn from Tippi Hedren's obsession with wildlife conservation.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the couples, they were married at the time, their discovery of this abandoned plantation that had been basically overrun almost like an Edgar Rice Burroughs plot by wild beasts.
Right.
And we got to make this movie. We got to make this movie. And it's like, of course, her career had itself gone south mm-hmm. by this time.
Mm-hmm.
You can pretty well encapsulate Tippi Hedren's career as a movie star to the pictures with Hitchcock.
Right. Now, she had done Herod Experiment.
Yes, the Herod Experiment as well, which got her noticed scarcely at all.
Mm-hmm.
People didn't go to see the Herod Experiment for any star power.
No, they didn't, especially older star power.
That was an Ogler's picture, plain and simple.
It was a hippie picture. It was the last kind of dying gasp of the hippie thing. But, you know, Roy
right.
Marshall was executive producer of that, and he was her agent, and I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think he was her agent when she was doing the Hitchcock pictures.
I believe that's right,
yeah. So she was not, she was not a box office draw at that time, I wouldn't think. Of course, it took what time? I mean, it took them, 5 years of principal photography to do this picture?
Oh, this started in what?
70s,
middle,
I think?
I want to say 76.
Yes.
We talked about that at some length when we had Tippi Hedren in for the one of the early Fort Worth film festivals.
Yes.
And she had brought with her, because the occasion at that festival was the official release of the Alfred Hitchcock stamp.
So
who better to, you know, the postage stamp, so who better to represent Hitchcock than one of his more prominent leading ladies?
One of his icy blondes.
Yes, exactly. And the condition that she imposed on this festival appearance was that she have a couple of hours in one of the larger auditoriums to do her wildlife conservation slideshow.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, what does that remind one of? Well, we should have gotten a print of Roar to go with the program.
Exactly.
There was, I think the picture had become by the 1990s pretty much a forgotten film, despite the controversy over numerous injuries and terrible inconveniences in
right.
making pictures.
And of some floods and some sort of big cat disease that came through, and all sorts of natural disasters, and all of that at their, as I understand it, at their ranch, correct? And also in Africa, where they were doing some filming.
Mm, yes, exactly. The official or the legendary casualty count is 70 injuries.
Yes, but no animals injured. Only only actors and crew members. Right?
You've seen the
Draft House thing.
The recent reissue.
Yes, that's right.
I think it was Tippi Hedren would not. Would not cite a number, but she said it was much lower than that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Melanie Griffith suffered a mauling.
Well, and Jan de Bont suffered a scalping.
Exactly.
And that was his first American picture, you know, and he went on a course to do some, boy, I'm sure it was an eye-opener.
So
to speak. Yeah. Well, did Tippi Hedren talk much about it when you had her down for the film festival?
There was a kind of a hesitancy at first, and then she realized that it was not the point of the discussion to fault her or disparage what was, for her, a very personal film.
Yes.
She became pretty much, she was very good-natured in talking about
mm-hmm.
it. explaining that she herself had experienced some injuries while filming Roar.
Right, right.
And, and a very strange experience it must have been, and you got that from her hesitancy. I think she and Noel Marshall had intended like a shoot of less than a year,
mm-hmm.
and she said they ended up shooting for 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's just the principal photography. And of course, they never really found a distributor.
Right.
I think it ran. It never really got a real American release. I think it ran for a week or something internationally, grossed a couple of $1 million, and I think it cost something like $17 million.
That's $17 million.
Yeah.
In the middle to late 70s would be tens of millions today.
Right, right, right. And it's, you know, the thing about it is it's a film that just makes you edgy all the way through. It makes mm-hmm. you nervous watching this picture. You don't know, and I think, you know, some of it is, I think we're empathizing with the cast, and they seem very creeped out about the whole thing all of the time.
Yeah, you just wonder how much of proto reality TV is in there.
Yes, you do, don't you? That's exactly right.
Except unlike modern day legalized snuff films that mm-hmm. reality TV is,
mm-hmm.
unlike the present day phenomenon, this was not. It was not. It had no prefabricated outcome.
That's right. That's right. And you remember it says at the very beginning there's some sort of a disclaimer about how the animals directed part of the picture. And this looks like a film that was directed partially by animals in some ways. They're animals' point of view. And I don't mean that as it's ham-handed. I just mean that there is so much empathy toward animals in the picture.
And that is Tippi Hedren all over.
Right, right.
She's very passionate about the cause of protecting endangered species.
Well, there was I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, no. I was saying the downside to this utter sincerity of the film is that it really feels it'd make a perfect double bill with Dennis Hopper's The Last Movie.
You mean a self-indulgent double bill?
Self-indulgent, and nobody really has the faintest idea of where they're going.
Right, right. I see what you're saying. Yeah, that does mm-hmm. make sense. That absolutely does. You do kind of get out of that film going. They kind of seem to tack that whole giving somebody to root for at the end when the evil guys go in and shoot the lions. And
yeah.
You get that, but before that, it meanders terribly, and all that it's got going for it is the very real anxiety that the people have with all of these lions that's transmitted mm-hmm. to the audience, and all of these big cats, and you know they're not tame.
And apart from the utter professionalism on view here, I mean, this is an technically expert, let's say.
Yes.
Good-looking picture.
Mm-hmm.
It's obviously not some amateur's home movie.
No.
But it has that same feeling. It conveys that same feeling that you get, expertise aside, from watching a picture like, well, an Ed Wood film, for example.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Or Manos, The Hands of Fate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like, what are we doing? Oh, we're making a movie. Well, how are you doing? Oh, we're just shooting it.
Right.
We're just shooting along. And flowcharts, no.
No.
Script, no.
No.
Scenario, yes. But a lot of spontaneity, and very few people can get away with spontaneous filmmaking.
Right. And I think the corollary to that, Michael, is that you step back from this picture and you think, who was their target audience? What was the target audience for this picture?
All due respect, I think their target audience was Tippi Hedren.
Or just a lot of lions, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the lions would love the picture. But I mean, it's not.
Well, I know tame household animals that watch movies on TV about animals.
That's right.
And including some dogs that when a dog on the television runs off screen, the dog runs around behind the TV to see where it
really?
Went.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
you have one of
imagine.
Those? Well, I just don't
Not
know.
Uncommon.
I mean, I think they were going for the Disney audience. I've read things that indicate that Born Free, the success of that, was what inspired them initially, provided the initial catalyst, the initial spark for them to do the picture.
Yeah, exactly. Born Free was made under safe conditions.
That's right. That's exactly right. And I
and
love
it had uplifting melodies, and
it did. I love the name of the villainous lion Togar, which I don't know which came first. Now that I think about it, was it Rock and Roll High School or was it Roar? Because of course, in Rock and Roll High School, Mary Warrenoff is Principal Togar.
Yes.
And so I have no idea. I mean, I'm sure Togar could. has been used in a lot of other places, and maybe one
sounds like a Jack Kirby comic book monster.
Right, exactly. Exactly. But doesn't Togar at some point remind you of Leatherface in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre films?
Oh yeah.
I mean, he's really got that vibe, right? It's really going. And I just don't know. I read one review online where a woman, and I want to give credit where credit's due, a woman named Emily Buder, I think it is B-U-D-E-R in IndieWire, said it was a Disney adventure dressed up in a snuff costume. And that's a very interesting insight, I think. And I'm not so sure that's kind of not right. It's got, you know, Charlie the Lonesome Coyote overtones, but it's just there's so many of them, for one thing. I mean, it almost becomes like a John Landis picture, like in Blues Brothers, where if, you know, one cop car crashing is funny, then 50 cop cars crashing must be 50 times as funny. You know, if one lion's good for a Disney film, then 100 lions must be 100 times as good.
A superfluous picture, but very disturbing and very unnerving. I don't know that I would consider it essential viewing, but anybody who's looking for that kind of precarious experience, waking dream state experience, where you know you're dreaming, you know you're watching a movie, you know that you, being aware of the dream or being aware of the viewing, you're free to turn it off at will.
Right.
But you don't. You
right.
don't.
Right. No. It's, you know, I keep thinking about that old deal that's attributed to Samuel Goldwyn, which is, I think is actually Moss Hart, but say, if you want to send a message, call Western Union. This is a message picture, right?
Quite so.
A message picture about, I mean, if you don't know it from the beginning and the end credit rolls, you know, you know it from what they're doing. They are passionate about saving wildlife. But it's not a very good example of why to save wildlife when, like, everybody in the cast is mauled at some point. And there's that one horribly creepy scene which I think is meant to be funny, where Tippi Hedren is covered with honey, where the honey jar falls on her.
Oh, yeah.
That's awfully difficult. That's as bad as anything in Last House on the Left, as far as I'm concerned. That's awfully unsettling. And I think it's supposed to be funny.
I wonder. I can see it both ways.
Yeah.
The difficulty of trying to convey an agenda in an entertaining form, well, let's say if most people shouldn't try it.
Yes.
And I'm not sorry to have experienced the movie, but it's like, gosh, couldn't you have done something a little bit more entertaining as opposed to this
unsettling?
Confrontational.
Yeah,
it's a very confrontational piece of work.
It is, but you know, when Draft House Films then released it to the art theaters in 2015, apparently it did, you know, for an art film, did very well. I mean, they're not anywhere like getting their money back, but I believe it grossed well over $100,000 in selected theaters, and people
and
went to the theaters.
And that was a limited release, which would be. Oh, probably, given the limitations of the reissue, probably comparable with the modest box office in 1981.
You know, probably so. You think it would have been about at that level then?
I don't have my inflation calculator in front of me, but yes, I think that would be reasonable to assume. Yeah.
And I guess it's still, I don't know what it's making on DVD and Blu-ray and everything, but you know, Draft House seems to know how to promote it.
Yeah.
And you know, the one we saw with Joey's print is I think it was Blu-ray, wasn't it, Joey? Blu-ray, and it had some, you know, it had features, and John, one of the sons that was in it, has a little bit of a Q&A on it, and it's obviously was just a film that just went south, and I don't know if they were so cut off from what the potential audience would be, or what, you know, they just went ahead and, like you said, they just went ahead and did it. We're making a movie. And you know, and the audience be damned, I guess. And at what point did they realize, you know, this was not going to be embraced by the casual family film goer that loved the Disney pictures? It was way, way different.
I think there was no marketing strategy even contemplated. The idea of, not all vanity films are lousy films.
No, of course not.
But a vanity film such as this one, no, it's like, basically, let's make a movie for ourselves.
Right. And for what we really care about.
Yeah, exactly.
And if the people or, you know, the audiences don't get it, well, we've still made a statement and helped maybe save some, in this case, save some African wildlife.
Yeah.
But it's very interesting picture. I don't know that I liked the picture. I know Joey likes it. Of course, Joey is the one, our producer Joey Hambrick, is the person who recommended The Bed That Eats People, as well as Roar. Those have been his two recommendations so far. So Joey represents a part of the Forgotten Horrors podcast that's no reason to be sorry. It's just sort of out there, and that's what we like. We like being challenged.
Once in a while, you just really need a good downer.
You just need a good downer, and this is a downer picture, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. More so even than one that I just recently rediscovered from that same period. I believe it was 1974, called Rage.
Yes, is that Brando? That's not Brando. Who? What is Rage?
George C. Scott,
that's who it is, yeah.
As the doomed rancher, taking revenge on the government.
That's right, yeah. And it's pretty downer too, right?
I had discovered the film never played widely, but I discovered it through its paperback novelization.
Mm-hmm.
And said, I got to find this film. I finally found it when it was still relatively new, and like, whoa, that was a D-double-O downer.
Well, I remember.
Recently looked it up again, and sure enough, it still is.
Yeah, well, a friend of mine back in the 70s when Raffleson was making, you know, films like King of Marvin Gardens and Five Easy Pieces, Raffleson and I'm losing that, Schneider, Bert Schneider, were making those films. My friend characterized them as films that, where people start out losers and end up losers. And there was a real strain of that in the late 1970s into the 80s, where everything had to end horribly, like Easy Rider, for instance, which predates that, I know, but everything had to end horribly, or badly, or just as a downer. You know, the kids, the hippie films and all of that, they all seem to have to end like that. And although they try and do something uplifting at the end of Roar, it's not very uplifting.
No, it's just they haven't learned anything by the end.
Yeah, and neither has the audience.
No.
Except that you really don't want to live in a house with like 150 lions. But I think the audience probably knew that going in. You know, I mean, it's not a revelation.
Exactly. Well, it's what I've often said, and I think I probably picked this up from Robert E. Howard, a story he wrote featuring Conan the Sumerian called Rogues in the House, about the ruler who takes a gorilla as a pet and domesticates it.
Right.
lets it live in the house and wear people clothes and gets the run of the house. Pretty soon the ape is thinking he's the lord of the manor.
Right, right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think those lions thought they were lord of the manor too.
Exactly.
My.
I own this house. Now I am the boss.
That's right. Ain't no Hank going to run me off. Run me off. Couple of things for film nerds such as ourselves. Look for Sugarfoot, Will Hutchins, in the scene in which they're having the powwow about whether or not to shoot the lions. They're having the little get together. Will Hutchins, who baby boomers know as Sugarfoot on the Warner Brothers TV series, and did a bunch of other stuff as well. I think Hey Landlord was was Hey Landlord him? Maybe so. The comedy. He did a couple of TV shows. I believe Will Hutchins was Hey Landlord. He ended up writing a couple of books. A friend of mine ended up living in the same apartment complex as him out in L.A. And he wrote a couple of, he's written a couple of books. But he is in a very, very brief scene. And additional script material for Roar was written by Ted Cassidy, Lurch from the Addams Family. And he actually was one of the three screenplay writers for Herod Experiment. So you've got all of that going, too. And those are, of course, the kind of things you'd love to look for and make connections with. And I know Ted Cassidy must have been chummy with the producer of the film and with Tippy and all of that from probably the Herod Experiment. Yeah. I would recommend that if you sit down to watch this, that you precede it. And Joey and I have been talking about this, and Emily, Joey's wife, certainly loves these pictures as well. The Dippy Doodads, a good Dippy Doodad short, which are available on, are those available where, Joey?
YouTube.
On YouTube. The Hal Roach films, featuring all animal casts, mostly monkeys, and the monkeys really look pissed throughout the entire pictures. They're wearing little hats and everything, and they just obviously are not liking it. And for some reason, it seems a perfect match with Roar. So lay out a Dippy Doodads free YouTube short, and then watch Roar, and you may never look at animals, especially mammals, the same way again. All right, speaking of looking at things, Michael, you've got a new book out, and I just finished it. Oh, I guess we should, old business, would you recommend Roar?
Well, of course.
Okay, good.
I wouldn't recommend it as a wholesome family hour viewing experience.
No. Keep the kids. It was PG when it first came out. They did submit it to the ratings board. It was a PG film. Keep the kids away from this. You know, we'd want kids to like the outdoors. You know, there's enough stuff to keep them indoors anyway with all these crazy newfangled, you know, phones.
Sure.
So, you know, we don't want to give them excuses not to get out and mix it up with animals. And this will give them a good excuse to not look at anything so much as a dog their entire youth.
There are keep away signs all over this.
There are indeed. And it's not, just be prepared to be creeped out from the very first frame. It is very creepy. You know, you've been around animal trainers, people who have animals. They're a different breed. They're a different kind of person. They look at the animals differently. I love animals, but they look at the animals a little differently. I know in your newspaper career and mine too, we dealt with, I remember one time dealing with the guy who trained the cougar for the, what was it? Mercury, I guess. The Mercury Cougars, and you know they had the cougar sitting on the hoods. Brought the cougar to the newsroom for me to do a story, and the cougar sat on top of my computer, which were those big, you know, terminals they called them then,
right.
Giant terminals like old TV sets, and looked down at me the whole time, sort of licking its lips. And, you know, at one point they were bringing the cougar up to the newspaper, the Tulsa World newspaper office, in the elevator. And the cougar didn't like the elevator, and it was just, and the trainer was just like jerking at the stop that, and the cougar's doing, and I was right there next to the cougar, and it was like, but for the trainer, looked at it a different way than I did, and
of course,
because of, he was
one of the more unnerving interviews I've done with was with Frank N, the animal trainer, when Benji.
Yes.
A hit film.
Yes, right. And, Texas boy, isn't he?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Benji, or officially named Higgins, had been a rescue, a pound rescue, mm-hmm. and trained very well, became the personable little pooch on Petticoat Junction, then became Benji, then so forth. But I have never seen such a dispirited dog.
Really?
Except when given commands to perk up,
mm-hmm.
and it's wow. like, no, you don't. You don't. There's a difference between taming and training.
Yes, yes.
And some overtraining can turn into taming and remove an animal's spirit.
Right. Exactly. I agree. And we're both dog lovers. I know that you're a dog person, and so am I. And we've got a cat around here named Bava who cares nothing for me. As a matter of fact, a couple of times when we've been over here doing this, she's attacked me. So I'm not a big dog person, but Joe and Emily are, or a big cat person, but Joe and Emily are. And the novel that I just finished has a lot of weird cats in it. So I guess I'm coming to terms with that. Anyway, speaking of books, let's talk about Deep in the Horrors of Texas, which I was privileged, and thank you for asking me to be a little part of with my little 5-page Barbarian Morning story. I'm really pleased to be in there with
story,
all of you guys, such a great lineup in that book. I mean, that Frank Thorne, tell me about, you begin the book with a Frank Thorne story that you have obviously redone dialogue and caption wise. Tell me how that came into your hands.
That was an orphan story that Frank turned loose of to some collector years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It was intended as a spinoff from Marvel.
Oh,
franchise
really?
Called Tomb of Dracula.
Yeah, Tomb of Dracula.
Tomb of Dracula. The uh-huh. character. The central character in the intended these aren't finished art, and except I did the finishing
right
myself.
Right.
These were like beautiful roughs. Mm-hmm. Frank Thorne's roughs looked like a lot of people's finished art.
Yeah, absolutely.
Intended to feature a character known as Hannibal King.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow things never fell together. It became an orphan story, and eventually the artwork fell into my hands, and I said, "Okay, this is never going to get anything done with it, mm-hmm. other than hoarded by one or collector or another."
Mm-hmm.
And so I did a bit of a digital restoration, cleanup, and polish on it. Not that it needed much polishing. And funny thing, The imposed dialogue excerpted from a dream journal that I keep
mm-hmm.
seemed to fit perfectly with a few adjustments.
It did fit perfectly. I don't know how many adjustments you made, but it fits perfectly. And it really sets up the whole book, which is just an incredible amalgam of artists and writers. There's so much in that book that's so much fun. And it's on Amazon right now. And you can get it there. And where else can you get it?
Well, actually, we just had a major little breakthrough of a sale to oldies.com.
Nice.
The Very Alpha nice. Video
sure.
web catalog.
Sure.
And, they've been had. Of course, oldies.com has been very loyal about handling forgotten horrors anyway over
mm-hmm.
the long term.
Mm-hmm. Good.
And
good.
So this one kind of spins off of that movie book series. Tremendous relationship between comics and movies, as
there
we've
are.
Demonstrated time and again.
Well, a couple of stories that you do, the one story you do that was the, I guess was the, was the basis for Starlight Slaughter, or whatever that Neville Brand picture was that Toby Hooper did when he went to Hollywood. Starlight Slaughter, I know, was one of the names. That's the crocodile fellow that you write about. That is a beautiful story.
That was originally done for a book Steve Bissett produced called Taboo.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And of course, the beauty of the indie comics scene is that creative talents retain their copyright.
That's right. That's right.
When I do a collaborative piece with like another artist, I assign 50-50 copyright,
mm-hmm.
allowing each latitude to do with it as one will.
Right.
Frank Stack and I invented that system. Well, it didn't invent it, but we started using a system like that years
mm-hmm.
ago.
Mm-hmm.
And as a consequence, the work Frank and I have done together has ended up in his anthologies, in my anthologies, in other publishers' projects, and as a consequence, both the creative talents benefit from what, in a conventional comic book industry would be a corporate property.
Right, and you've got some stuff from Heavy Metal in there too, which was a big magazine at one point, and you still managed to retain those copyrights as well.
Yeah, we did that murder case.
Mm-hmm.
What's a murder case doing in Heavy Metal?
Right.
Well, they wanted it, so they got it.
And they got it. It's a beautiful story.
And of course, it's a car bomb story, and I, mm-hmm. my argument was, well, there's not much metal heavier than an exploding automobile.
That's exactly right. Exactly. Well, it's a wonderful book. It's called Deep in the Horrors of Texas, and it's brand new, just came out, and I would really recommend it for anyone who loves adventurous reading. And there's even a few of those Theater of the Absurd Ajax Farrell things that you do that I love in there as well. There's just a little bit of everything. It's a beautiful volume, Michael. You'll be very proud of it.
I'm delighted to hear that.
Well, it really is, and I'm delighted to be a part of it.
That's one of the greater delights we have.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And I do want to mention also that the Ralph Terry book, it's baseball season. If you want to read about one of the real, maybe overlooked heroes a little bit from the early 1960s, told in his own words, the only man to pitch the last pitch of two World Series Game 7s, Ralph Terry from 1662. I was privileged to be able to do his As Told To biography. We've got some wonderful reviews. I have to say, and this is, I know I'm tooting my own horn, but I'm going to do it anyway, because of Ralph's stature as one of the great Yankees on those teams of the 60s, early 60s, we were reviewed in a lot of places. We were mentioned in New York Times, New York Daily News, and Boston Globe said it was as charming and readable as a book like this can be. And to me, that's one of the greatest reviews I've ever gotten. So that's called Right Down the Middle, and it's available on Amazon.com.
Well, I guarantee you, it'll make you, even one who approaches it from a non-fan basis is going to end up liking baseball.
Well, thank you very much. It's just like sitting down and talking to the guy, and that's when I can do that. And, you know, our newspaper training did that for us, Michael. You know, we can sit mm-hmm. down with a guy, and we can transmit his personality or her personality in the quotes, because we've learned how to do that as newspaper men.
You learn how to do it, and you learn sooner or later, every earnest journalist learns not to interview but to converse.
Very good. Very good. I couldn't have put it better myself. Well, Michael, since the last podcast, we've lost one of our very, very good friends and one of the greatest writers and playwrights I've ever known, and that's Jim Vance.
Jim Vance. Mm-hmm. Jim Vance. What a cat.
What a guy he was. You know, we all used to do those. He would ride down with me from Tulsa, and we would do the Dallas Fantasy Fairs together. Matter of fact, I think the two of us met you on one of those trips.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that was a very good connection spot, the Dallas convention was. And, of course, Jim probably did more for the comics industry than any other editor I've known, short of maybe Mark Martin.
When he was with Kitchen Sink, you're talking about?
When Jim was with Kitchen Sink,
mm-hmm.
About the time that Mark was with Tundra.
Mm-hmm.
Both doing not so much in terms of volume or high profile within the industry, but in terms of emphasizing quality of material over quantity of material.
Yes, I would agree.
And Jim practiced what he preached with those matched Depression-era novels, Kings in Disguise and On the Ropes.
Oh, my. What a wonderful pair of books those are. And, you know,
I tell you,
they're Steinbeckian. They really are, aren't they? I mean,
oh yeah. Well, that's how I met Dan Burr, through Jim Vance.
Mm-hmm. Dan Burr, the artist, of course. Yeah.
Yes, and I noticed the art right off. I says, "My gosh, this guy's like Bill Elder playing it straight."
Mm-hmm. It's a very good way to put it. Absolutely.
And of course, Elder never liked to play it straight. So when occasionally he was saddled with a serious story at EC, you could tell that his heart wasn't in it.
That's right.
I think what Jim brought out in his artists, predominantly Dan Burr, was the sense of immersion in a period, the Depression, and a vitality of storytelling that inspired the artist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I absolutely agree. He wrote it like he wrote his plays. He was a playwright.
Oh, yeah.
His playwriting.
Yeah. I've seldom seen a novelist, playwright, scriptwriter, scenarist, whatever word you want to use. I've never seen another talent in that sphere so thoroughly able to inspire his attached talents.
Yeah.
Actors
yeah.
on stage, on screen. Illustrators on the printed page.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, Jim always hated it because I would always bring up Blood Cult, which was essentially the first made-for-home video movie that got any sort of distribution at all.
Yeah.
From United Entertainment, which at that time, well, it's VCI now, it was United Entertainment then. But Jim and I met that night. I had written about Blood Cult for the Tulsa World and for Fangoria, for some other publications, and so I was there. And it was they had this big premiere at one of the venues in Tulsa, and one of the sort of hoity-toity venues. It was one of those places where they have the brass fish, and one of them like there's white wine coming in a little fountain out of its mouth, and red out of the other, and the stacks of cheese and crackers, and I remember sort of partaking of the wine, and my wife, Janice, as you know, is not a horror movie fan, and so I took my friend Vern Stefani, who later on directed some stuff for me and worked with me on a script that we sold to United Entertainment, which was never made because of various reasons. But I'm sitting there, and of course the wine is kicked in by the time Blood Cult starts, and you've seen Blood Cult, and I was having a wonderful time with it. And Vern keeps elbowing me and saying, "That's Jim Vance. That's Jim Vance." Turned out Jim Vance was sitting right next to me. And at the very end, we introduced ourselves, and that was 1985, and we were friends ever since. We were good friends ever since. I know he was your house guest several times. We spent so much time talking about the very films, and, you know, Jim would be a perfect person to be on these podcasts and to listen to the podcast. He loved these pictures. And,
There's our ideal audience distilled to an essence. You know, we've lost a lot of important figures in the profession in recent months. Tom
yes.
Rinone.
Yes.
The loss of Bernie Wrightson.
Yes.
The proto undergrounders Jay Lynch and Skippy Williamson.
Yes.
Jim Vance. You know,
yeah.
Jim did not keep as high a profile as many of those major talents, but I think his contributions are comparable and transcendent.
I've never seen a graphic novel better than Kings in Disguise. I've never seen a better one. You know, and
it goes back. It comes back and back and back, and you can read it again and again and again without losing interest, and certainly with gaining interest.
Well, at the risk of being pathetic, I would like to dedicate this particular podcast to Jim and Jim's spirit, because I know, and I did the funeral for Jim. I presided over the funeral for Jim, and I know what he loved, and I know he would have loved this. And I watch a film, you know, last week I watched a film, and I started thinking, I'm going to call Jim and see what he thinks about it, and we'll talk about it. And of course, you can't do that anymore. So I think his spirit certainly hovers over what we do here, and not to make, you know, not to put too fine a point on it or make it sound sappy, but Jim will always be with us, right?
I should think so.
Thank you, Michael. We'll be talking again soon.
Won't be long.
Okay. Bye.
There's a fire in the sky in the morning when the sun is a crimson dawning and the earth is aglow like a burning ember. Whose land is this? This is mine.